Good day and welcome to episode 26 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. And if you are listening to us on CFRU-FM, a Merry Christmas to you. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. A bit of a departure today from the politics side of things, our special guest is Bonnie Dirtnell, a remarkable resource in Guelph as the keeper of so much knowledge about labor history and human stories. Today, Bonnie is focusing on the Great Depression, the strikes, and the labor situation then, relating it to what's happening now in the economic downturn exacerbated by COVID. We don't have the advantage of some of the historical slides Bonnie shared with us, but as they say, you'll get the picture. Here's Bonnie, and then you'll hear from our moderator, Dustin Brown.
The topic is the Great Depression, including strikes and other matters relating to it. Canada never really had the Roaring Twenties in the same way that the States had. The economy was not significantly booming, though in Guelph's The Ward, people like the Veronis working with Rocco Perry made money exporting booze to the U.S. Then on October 29th, 1929, came the crash, plunging employers and employees alike into a new economic reality. 1 year later, 400,000 Canadians were out of work. Wages were cut, and those employed had to live on less pay. Businesses retrenched, and the labor movement was brought to a temporary standstill. The number of strikes declined as businesses closed, and the labor supply increased disproportionately. When workers did revolt against a decrease in wages, an increase in hours, unsafe working conditions, or the treatment of unions and their organizers, the matter was predominantly settled in favor of the employer. During the early years of the Depression, several types of workers came under fire. Both married and single women were the subject of much discussion. People on city council, including Charles Dawson, felt married women in particular should leave their jobs if their husbands were gainfully employed. Others wrote letters to the editor complaining about young women, saying how frivolous it was for them to remain employed. They felt, and this was not uncommon throughout both the 19th and 20th centuries, that such women did not need to work. They could stay at home with their parents. One more group that came under harsh criticism, but was also harshly treated, were single men. Released from their employment in favor of married men, they were more often than not unable to even collect relief. In one case in Guelph, a young man was rejected from receiving relief because he could live at home with his father, who had a shop and was sometimes working. And oh my God, he was seen visiting a local pool hall. So obviously he was another frivolous person. One of the results of such discrimination was the formation of the Unemployed Workers Association, a group affiliated with the Workers Unity League. This was a communist organization. They sprung up across the country. They included a general group as well as a single unemployed workers association group. As the Depression settled in Guelph, the council passed a resolution to consider the single jobless. They decided to send this particular group of men to relief camps, which would look much like the one that's on the screen. Which ones Guelph members were sent to, I don't exactly know, but they were sent north to work on highway construction. In November 1931, 71 were sent to what was called then New Ontario or Northern Ontario. And to anybody who lives in Kent Borden or now Base Borden, which is close to Barrie, it's not north, but if you're from Toronto or Guelph or anywhere south of Barrie, that's north. So relief camps were, some were well run and the men were treated decently. In others, they were often referred to as slave camps. Strict rules were applied, and much was expected for sometimes as little as 20 cents a day. You may get more in wages working there, but you had to pay for any what the army would have called necessities, including your board, if not your room, as well as medical. The camps offered no opportunities for the single men who resided there. The food was often inedible, bed bugs plentiful, and the work clearing swampland to create highways, which is sort of the beginning of the Trans-Canada Highway, was hard. Isolated from communities, because often they were placed far away from anywhere, such as even a village, they offered no entertainment, no books, no sports, and no alcoholic drinks. And these are city-raised men, and so they often faced dreary day after dreary day without hope. By 1932, Guelph was told not to send any more people to the camps. The camp, like many others across Canada, was full. The government came up with another temporary solution called relief settlements. Municipalities sent individuals or families to farm in New Ontario. Each city, upon acceptance, paid $100 per person and another $100 at the beginning of their second year. They were told they could pick between basically two possibilities. Abandoned farms, which means the farms weren't really well going at the beginning, and small holdings. Guelph had 12 families living in Northern Ontario in March 1934, and they were hoping to send more under the new system. Throughout, however, many married and single workers were hired by the city to work on what were called relief gangs. They were hired in 530 of them, and in 1934 were working on Arkell Springs and other civic work projects, including the paving of Aramosa Road or Hill, the widening of the College Hill or the bottom of Gordon, and excavation of the river at the bottom of Gordon Hill and building of the retaining walls along the river from Gow's Bridge to Johnston's Boathouse. So all that paving wall that's built along there, most of it was built by relief workers. And this would include both married and non-married families as well. It was not just restricted to individuals who sometimes couldn't get relief. Across Canada between 1930 and 1934, unions were stifled. Many local councils kept mum. They were afraid they and their workers would lose their jobs, so it was easier to keep quiet. This all changed in 1934 when strikes began to resurface as a means of expressing frustration with the current conditions. In Guelph, one of my favorite strikes, one of the more interesting strikes, occurred in 1934. It began when Mayor Robson talked to the owners of Superior Cloakworks in Toronto. Samuel and Louis Poslins, who their family later on went on to absorb Tip Top Taylor, agreed the relocation of Superior Cloakwork to Guelph would be beneficial on all levels. On July 19th, 1934, the Guelph Mercury confirmed the deal. It wrote that the Superior Cloak Company of Toronto would be moving to Guelph into the former steel wire company building on Baker Street. It was to share these premises with the Popular Cloak Company. That company had only opened about a month previously. What the local newspapers did not know, and Louis Poslins, the owner of Superior, did not tell them, was that the workers in the Toronto shop were unaware of this decision. These employees were member of the International Lady Garment Workers Union. They had been formed in 1900 in New York and were known for being more than a little radical, although they still had a gender bias. The ILGWU was one of the founding members of the CIO, which gives an indication of their leanings. They had no idea that Pawsons was going to close up shop, transfer the machinery to Guelph, and hire cheaper non-labor union. When they finally did find out, the workers, with the backing of their union, including the redoubtable Samuel Kreisman, decided they had to make a decision. The result? Life in Guelph was about to become very interesting. The workers at Superior Cloak had nothing to lose. They were effectively locked out from their work. But initially, only a few employees made it up the highway to Guelph to march in front of the Superior Popular Cloakwork Company. Kreisman took the forefront and warned in a speech made in front of City Hall on July 27th that the strike would extend from Toronto into the city. Alderman C.E. Fulton, who later ran for the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the CCF party, originally created by J.S. Woodsworth, supported him, as did the Guelph Trades and Labor Council president at that point, William Halliday. Fulton ramped up the rhetoric at a special meeting of city council, stating that he would not be party to any industry that, quote, came here for the purpose of getting out from under an agreement with the union, end quote. In fact, the removal of Superior Cloak to Guelph was all part of Pawson's desire to get rid of the union he hated, which was the ILGWU. This is an instruction to pickets, basically a guide as to how to picket, posted by the Guelph, by the International Leading Garment Workers Union. However, it began as a small peaceful information picket of a few workers, and late July was begin to change its character later on. Guelph's town streets were suddenly flooded with visiting striking workers. Baker Street, for the 10 days the strike lasted, became a tourist spot. One headline in the local paper read, "Baker Street is a mecca for a huge crowd as strikers continued." By August 21st, 1934, when the first serious trouble began, 200 Toronto workers had driven from Toronto for a meeting with Samuel Kreisman. Just before 8 a.m. on Upper Wyndham near the Cutton property, quote, "bricks flew fast and furious as workers at the cloak works fought with strikers. This wild melee raged up and down Wyndham, spilling onto Quebec and Baker Streets. The police and the fire department were called in, the latter hosing down anyone caught up in the fray. The violence continued into the next day." The headline for the Guelph Mercury read, "Guelph police arrest six more strikers. Stones hurled during fresh strike rumpus outside cloak company plant." This was the nature of the event for several days, a strike in which, oddly enough, Kreisman, the union agent, and Pawsons, the company owner, were housed in the same hotel. They faced off each other every day. While Kreisman was accused of inciting the strikers, it was Pawsons who was charged with, quote, "discharging a loaded revolver with intent to injure," end quote. On the morning of Thursday, August 22nd, 1934, the strikers arrived around 6 a.m. on Baker Street, determined to prevent anyone from entering both the Superior and Popular Cloakworks. Members of the Guelph Labor Defense League, which was supported by the Communist Party of Canada, which was founded in Guelph, soon joined them. For 2 days, all was quiet, but tense. On Saturday, the situation became highly volatile, with stones and bottles flying between the crowd and the striking cloak workers. The barrage lasted about an hour until tear gas was used against the striking workers. Several officers bruised by bottles and stones tossed by strikers standing just out of reach of the fire hose certainly earned their pay. After calm was restored, the police actually admitted that many of the rioters were citizens of Guelph and not strikers. These residents were expressing exactly what they thought about the strike. Many did not approve of the high cost the city was paying for police guards to remove goods from the factory at night. In fact, they were being paid as much as $5 a day and hotel expenses. Some citizens even gladly took part in the riots, including some children who sat on a nearby roof and tossed down bricks at those trying to enter the plants. Both the employed and unemployed were expressing their distaste for company tactics and at the same time venting their rage against the depression. The Mercury was quick to point out who else was not averse to the sudden influx of newcomers. The paper noted, Guelph Hotels are doing a land office business as a result of the garment workers' strike here. Strikers and police all have to be accommodated, and when in addition to the various out-of-town authorities are seeking hotel rooms, the demand increases steadily. Two or three have been completely filled, and in at least one instance, strikers and police slept in the same hotel. As the strike continued, Mayor of Guelph, criticized for not doing enough, was threatened by calls for his resignation. He did seek help from the Attorney General of Ontario at the time, General Arthur Roebuck. However, according to Roebuck, who held a meeting of all involved parties, Robson was of little help. The Peterborough Examiner quotes Roebuck saying Robson had, quote, screamed for bayonets, end quote. This was a charge Robson denied, although he did say he had sought police support from Roebuck, which fortunately he never gave. Whatever the mayor's request, he was saved from resigning as the strike ended on August 30th. The LGW won. Popular Cloakworks stayed in Guelph, Superior Cloakworks returned to Toronto, and Guelph garment workers benefited. Popular Cloakworks was unionized the following year when they went out. The strike was settled in a few days. The union reached a compromise with management on a wage increase. By this time, the ILGWU had helped form the CIO. Mayor Robson also held on to his position, and he was actually re-elected again. The same year of the Cloaks work strike, Guelph formed a single men's unemployment association. At this time, the Unemployed Association or Unemployment Association was viewed as being socialist or communist in nature. The RCMP Security Bulletin for 1933 to 1936 makes several mentions of the Guelph Association and their members, including Lawrence Cunningham, who helped form and who was one of the few people that I know and is always mentioned at being at the initial formation of the Communist Party of Canada, whereas others, it's a little questionable. I think everybody, it's like Woodstock, everybody claims that they were there at some point. Farrell and James Ritchie, who used to work for the Guelph Stope Company, are also noted as people to watch by the RCMP, supported by, a member of the Unemployed Association, Walter Davis, taking part in the Hunger March, which was an Ontario part of the On to Ottawa trek that usually ended up in Toronto. Supported by a letter from the GTLC, the Guelph Unemployed Association sent a deputation to City Council in March seeking support. The mayor, as I said, Robson, informed them, quote, the council's first obligation is to the married man with a family and children. The UA were content to accept this. Well, maybe not content, but they accepted this until on April 14th, 1937, they decided to take a stand against a system that increasingly paid them in vouchers, including medical vouchers that had been introduced in 1936, instead of cash or sometimes even half cash. They went to council asking also for an increase of 8% in the food allowance, claiming that their children were often going not going to school, properly clothed, and sometimes not fed. Unfortunately, their pleas fell on deaf ears. Councillor Hamilton, and in particular, Frank, were refusing to deal with them. A small scuffle in Riverside Park resulted in the arrest of one frustrated Unemployment Association worker. In the end, it was all for naught. The Labour Council did not support them in the final days, and they were forced to return to work. The association stating they did so, quote, we believe It would be folly for the men to any longer refuse and punish their families after the starvation policy of the city official has broken the spirit of a considerable number of men. It may be that the Labor Council was more focused on helping the iron molders at Taylor Forbes succeed. On April 20th, they went out for an increase in wages and a decrease in their hours. On May 3rd, they went back to work having achieved compromise, which became common in the latter years of the Depression. And this is Alderman Albert J. Frank, who was one of the proponents of not giving in to the Unemployment Association. On other strikes were more successful. On July 13th, 1938, 100% of Biltmore Hat's workforce, which was 300 men, walked off the job. Management had refused to talk with union members about intolerable working conditions and failed to recognize the union. In fact, the company had fired several employees who had been working for the union. Initially, it was an orderly protest. However, 2 days after the strike commenced, when police officers drew their billy clubs against peacefully demonstrating workers, the peaceful pickets turned into a small melee. The confrontation was brief, and for the next few days, the pickets again resumed a peaceful demonstration. Then 3 days later, on July 19th, a truck delivering some unfinished hats was stopped by the picketers. While the driver was phoning for directions, several picketers pushed the truck up Suffolk Street. Two policemen arrived and another skirmish took place, the officers again drawing out their clubs. Picketers drew back, only to react when the driver returned. One officer was pushed about and another knocked to the ground. Billies were drawn out once more and a battle ensued. Nearby Guelphites, who seemed to be in favor of the workers, decided to help out the picketers by tossing the hats out of the truck and scattering them up and down Suffolk Street. This action served as a warning to another trucker who, when told what had happened, left. There was no repeat of this incident. The violence ended, but not the strike. Local citizens continued to help out in other ways. They had the canteen, which was, as usual, female. Yet what is particularly noteworthy is the composition of the Biltmore Strike Committee. It was not the stereotypical all-male group. This is a photo of the group, which includes two women. And I have no idea who their names were. I've asked around and nobody seems to know who they were. An agreement between Biltmore and the strikers was not released until July 27th. It is in it, the firm agreed to recognize the union and also to take steps to remedy the problems at the plant. This was a great victory for Hat Workers Union Local 182, which was a CIO union formed in 1934 in New York, like the ILGW. This CIO union was slowly making its way through into Canada, along with several others, not always with great success, as another battle waged in 1939 at the Northern Rubber Company reveals. This time, the employer thought he could unilaterally reduce wages by 12%. The 325 workers at Northern Rubber went out. And this was quite a courageous move, since they did so without union representation, although they were being wooed at that time by both the AFL and the CIO. They were out from July the 6th to the 19th, 1939. However, they won, returning to work on a compromise. Wages were decreased by 5% and not what was 12%, and a closed union shop was agreed upon. The mainly Catholic workers had helped choosing their union. After being harangued from the pulpit in Sacred Heart Church, the workers were convinced the CIO was a communist group and would not be good for them religiously, socially, economically. In fact, it said they burnt their literature before opting for an AFL union. The now union workers were to go out once more in 1940 for 3 days in July as the company began replacing men with women and boys on a larger scale and therefore reducing the old wage scale, replacing the old age scale with a new reduced one. However, by then, the employees faced new challenges on the labor front. Economic and social conditions had changed once more, and Canada was at war. And so that concludes my talk, and I'm sure there's questions.
Okay, well, Bonnie, I was going to do this later, but do you want to just talk about working it out and also your new book and your website and where people can contact you?
Okay, my two books, Body House Bums and Illicit Booze, and Body House Scallywags, Thieving Scoundrels and Illicit Booze, look at rather the dark side of Guelph, the fun side of Guelph sometimes, at prostitution and murder, illicit booze running in the ward, including the Veronis, but also before that, how people reacted to the Scott Act and their way of rebelling against it, as well as the different treatment, which is in one, about how vagrants and bums were treated, how that changed in the 1930s when there were far more coming through Guelph, and the look towards it. Initially, they even had built in the City Hall area a shower for the original bums who came. But then as more and more came in the 1930s, that outlook totally changed. Originally, it was if a bum appeared, then you would just say, okay, you're locked in jail for maybe the night, and then you're kicked out and leave town. So that, and the other one introduces some of the thieves, including Guelph's version of Dick Turpin, and along those lines. So, and some of the murders, some of them are sad. Some of them are, murders that were committed and never the perpetrators were never found, though in one case the Veronis were thought to be at fault, but the Veronis were never caught, though Veroni did get his comeuppance later on when he was killed, shot, dead, Niagara Falls, while on a business trip. Okay.
Yeah, fascinating. We've got a few questions in the chat that I'm seeing. I'm going to echo some thoughts I'm seeing in the chat that, Bonnie, this is an incredible, knowledge that you're sharing with us. Specifically, Robert Morris was saying that this topic would make a great exhibition at the museum, saying, it's amazing what historical details are available. So I just wondered, is that something that you've tried to get into the museums, or have you had any success there?
No, I haven't. I did years ago, I guess 2004, 2005 or something like that. I did an exhibition at the old museum called Laboring All Our Lives, which is the title of my web page and my Facebook page. And maybe in a book if I ever rewrite Working It All Out. And that explored some of the specifically relating to Guelph, that topic. The 30s was included, but it was looked at more. It was a focus more on 1900s, no, more like 19th century, early 1900s Guelph and working conditions there. And it's hard to find any material or artifacts specifically from that. I mean, I've gathered a few things from my collection, but and they're all related to Guelph, but most of them, of course, are promos, and a few of them are products. There's, a few no letters written by anything, and that's the problem. We don't have even union records. I have the earliest trade and labor. It's 1959, and it goes back a little earlier. I think it's about 1959. It's when in Guelph, in the 30s, when the CIO arrived, they had, when the CFL or whatever it was at that point, the Canadian Federation of Labor or whatever it was called at that time, eventually kicked out the CIO a little later than the AFL did. The CIO formed their own little labor congress and their own little councils. So Guelph had two of them at the same time. And they were actually the first that got together in 1959, 1956. I get a little foggy after the 40s. They were joined together to create one union and one Congress. So I have the earliest records of them and when they're talking about uniting. But otherwise, there isn't really very much. The Labor Council doesn't have anything before that. And I'm lucky that I found this book because originally the council had it. And then somehow in one of their moves, they lost it. And someone pointed it out somewhere in a garage sale or whatever. They had it and I got it. So that's the earliest records of that. During the 30s, when companies folded, a lot of the papers were lost. You know, even the early companies are gone. We have nothing. You know, Sleeman's has a whole bunch of papers, but that doesn't, you know, don't have anything else. So it's hard, very hard to put together anything like that. Visually, it can be done. And the Depression would be mainly headlines and companies and, but it depends upon what the museum wants to do too, in which direction. And right now they're not taking any artifacts. They're not taking anything for the even paper archival material or suggestions. Or my latest book isn't going into the museum because they've frozen everything because of COVID and they're assessing their needs and the direction they want to go. So, and then I got rambling again. Okay.
Oh, that's great, Bonnie. You actually, I think you answered a lot of this question from Mandy, which I'll present verbatim. But if you want to elaborate on any thoughts, feel free to do so. So Mandy asked, how do you do your research, Bonnie? What are the best sources of information on Guelph history and where do you find them? And
okay.
Then also connecting with something you just said, Mandy asked, how does or will the loss of the Guelph Mercury affect research on local history?
Oh, that would be, you know, a lot. Guelph Today has that's online. The only thing now is that people keep records and records are kept longer and they're not just tossed aside or used to stuff inside walls. I've used a lot of the early papers, even in the early research, because there's so little known, because I'm putting together, which may be finished by the time I'm dead, a directory on early Guelph industries. And in any research, you have the only sources we really have are the early newspapers. So I will sit there and go through a reel. Now, the problem with the 1930s is a lot of the newspapers don't exist. Months. And that goes for some of the early papers, but the 30s were particularly hard hit. So, for instance, May Day celebrations. I know a couple took place in Guelph, but as for the other days, no. And one of the reasons I knew that one of them took place was because I was looking at the RCMP security bulletins. And they're released and they're in hardback. I think Keeley put them out. And so you can read through them and they'll find and show you Guelph, you know, dissidents that they were watching, like Lawrence. So you know that Lawrence Cunningham was important, at least in the eyes of the RCMP. So you go through those and then correlate it to the newspapers. And then you look at obits. But even obits sometimes aren't there, or because the person who was really active in early Guelph labor history wasn't active anymore and they don't mention in his obit. So you can't really find out much there. It's against the newspapers going through. The early, like Johnson's and the other couple of books on Guelph, or David Allen's is good. It's good for basic background material for the early days, and they'll give you a list. Stewart's book is okay, except Stewart's book can be very frustrating, especially you have to read about how much he adored and hated his mother at the same time. And he will also say, this building was at the corner of so-and-so and so-and-so streets. There are four corners sometimes, that's no help. And the city directories themselves can help because they will give you the names of a business that was there maybe only that year. Like there was one that I'm still trying to find out. It was a match company that was listed in Guelph. I could only find it once, and that was not in the city directories, but the other one are the industrial files that the government put out, the factory reports. And later on, the labor department put out reports. But the factory bureau did a bunch of reports, including early accidents. And then you look at the accident there, and then you compare it to the newspapers. It can be frustrating, but I love it. It's something that I get into and I really enjoy. And that's how I found out the material for the body house, because I would be looking for, okay, when was this union formed? And then I'd see, oh, soiled dove arrested. Cool. What's a soiled dove? You know. And what can also be frustrating is some of the material that was with the companies or with the unions has during the 1930s or before is moved back to the States. And I haven't really a way of accessing the material unless I want to pay a researcher to do it or want to go down to the States. And right now I think I'm totally avoiding, you know, the various states. And sometimes I have written off letters, and one of them was I had the number of a union local, the name of the union local, and sent it off to see if I could find information. And they sent me back saying, oh, no, that number was so-and-so. And I said, but according to the Department of Labor and the union itself, this was their number local. And they're going, nope. So it can be frustrating, but fun. If you have a masochistic turn like I do or something like that. Okay, any other questions?
Sounds like the whole labor movement in and of itself. Mandy, you had a follow-up question just connecting the past to present, so go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if you have a comment on this, but I was wondering, since you know so much about the history, If you can think of any ways that like past labor struggles and the ones that are happening today are similar and how they're different, and if there's stuff that you think that workers today could really learn from knowing a bit more of the history.
Okay.
I know that's a big question.
It's a good question. Well, if we take a look at the fiberglass strike or Crowning Royal, whatever it's called there. They've gone out on several strikes they were actually one of the first in Guelph to go out on a wildcat strike in the 1960s. I looked up them a little bit. Otherwise I wouldn't remember that far in the 1960s. But some of it is, it's a lot of it is just repetition. You're going to have this clash between the company and the workers. It's in a capitalist system, it's always going to be, it's human nature anyways, partly, but you're going to have the workers have this idea and the company has this idea. And the company's focus, I think increasingly more, even more than in the 1930s, everybody was worried. And it was all right, and I'll say it's acceptable for the workers to, you know, take cuts if the company is going to take cuts too. Like in Guelph, there were a couple of companies that were cooperative, that in the sense of the company understood the workers' plight rather than just blame the workers and hack everything. Calendar Foundry has always been a good company, originally before they were taken over by, when Calendar Foundry was in operation and bad times came along, what they did was they tried to keep everybody employed. And if you came back from World War II, even though you shouldn't maybe have had the job because you weren't mentally capable of handling it, they would try to fit you in and give you your job back, so you would, you know, integrate back into the community. So we have companies that try to do that. Companies like even I think Creepy Harding, though they weren't Harding at the time, did try so that when they repaired the roof, they did local workers. So they were trying to keep the economy going and trying to do the best that they could, rather than going in and blaming female workers, blaming married women. And you can see, though, at the time that that's their logic, and that's what you have to understand. And workers and employers, one thing I'm trying to say is employers and employees are often talking in different languages. So when you're talking in different languages, you're not communicating. Now, the one thing they have in common is money. They both want money. They want the company to survive. But they're talking and looking, they're talking in the sense of they're looking at it differently. The employer is just looking at the company as a whole. He wants the company to survive. And his major difference is he wants the shareholders, and you don't get that so often in the early period. You don't have this third party involved. Today, too many companies are going, well, we have to keep the shareholders happy. We have to keep the shareholders company. Screw the employees. We have to keep the shareholders company. Whereas before, most of the companies, until some of the internationals, were not, were locally invested. So they try to keep the company going and try to keep the workers going. You get a lot more trouble when you've got the companies that are internationals coming in, or mainly at that time, American franchises. And so they do what a lot of franchises do. When things get rough, you go running home to mommy, and mommy is the parent company. So you just abandon everything. And so I think it's a matter of investing in the employees. And I don't think that's something that companies today, or even companies back then, did a lot of, was investing in the employees. Colonial Whiteware might be an exception. They always try to keep their companies going. Companies that had that open to unions and realize that working with unions was in their benefit if the union and the company can get on the same page. So it's a matter, I think, of learning. Everybody has to learn, and it's a terrible word, but it's to compromise, because you cannot always get your own way, either top or bottom. It's not going to, it's like a marriage. But if the workers feel alienated, which is what happened with the United, you know, like the employees for the Unemployment Association, they felt alienated. And they were, essentially, they were alienated because of how they were treated by city council, who was handling the relief program. The Trade and Labor Council would only back them so far, and they weren't officially a union of any sort. They weren't apples, they weren't oranges. They were like, and they were easily to jettison. And so, you know, it's not a simple issue. And economic times always put stress on it. But as some companies have proven, like, even if you want, you take the difference between Walmart and Costco. If you ask employees at Walmart, not in front of the boss, of course, are they happier than workers at Costco? Costco will tell you that they're happier because they've got benefits, they've got a fairly good working relationship, they have all sorts of things that Walmart hasn't. And yet Costco still continues to make money, not just because they're bare walls stuff, but they continue to make money because they know that their workers are happier. And that's the whole point. You should make sure that your workers are happier. And then they're willing to make little sacrifices if the company makes sacrifices. I mean, nothing's going to piss off a worker more than if he sees this, that your employer is asking you to take a pay cut, but the CEO gets a bonus. And that's not the way it should work. So there is no simple solution. And I don't know if I've even answered your question, because I've just gone on rambling.
I'll ask a follow-up to that. You brought up the Owens Corning Wildcat strike in the 60s. And I guess
they went on strike before that too. Okay. They've gone on strike several times.
I guess you could call a wildcat strike kind of the result of workers not being happy with that compromise between the company and the union leadership. So
yes.
I wonder if you could elaborate more on kind of wildcat strike history in Guelph or whatever you're aware of it.
Because there are several strikes in the 1960s that classified as wildcat strikes, and they were not... Like the one that Fiberglass did was not sanctioned by their union, and they went in shortly after. But then they went out later on too, on a sanctioned strike. Because 1964, there were a fair lot of strikes. Some of them were wildcat and some weren't. Federal Wire was one of the big ones. In July 1966, fiberglass employees walked off their job. 146 employees on the 7 a.m. shift left the plant at 7:45. That's when they had the textile workers union was in charge. The record for wildcat strikes in Guelph in the 1960s was held by the workers at Dayton Steel, which doesn't exist anymore. They went out three times in 1965. All walkouts were unauthorized and considered wildcat strikes. They went out April the 5th. It lasted a few hours. April the 6th, 150 workers went out. They were told to go back by the union, but they went out again on April the 7th and stayed out until April 14th. And the union didn't like that at all. It was a matter of grievances. The workers felt that they had not given the right amount of attention to their employees. So it was just an ongoing problem that they faced. And they decided that that workers at that point realized or thought that the unions weren't listening to them and the company wasn't listening to them. So that was the only way they could make their point. And they had 27 different grievances at that time. It was lighting, poor ventilation, and the lack of safety guards for the machinery. And they also wanted a proper lunchroom. And the Department of Labor sided with the employees at that point. And the inspectors came to town and they looked at it and they said that something would be done. And so that was, it's like management of the union and the union. So generally that's what it is.
Okay, thanks Bonnie. And yeah, certainly it's a courageous thing for workers to do and a highly organized thing for workers to do without union approval. We'll move on. We have, by my record, we have three questions left and about 10 minutes. So just keeping that in mind. Phil wanted to know, how did the war affect labor unrest and wages? And that is referring to World War II.
Okay, World War II. Okay, World War II, as far as wages go, some of them actually went up because they were a shortage of men. But at the same time, if you took on war work, and a lot of plants in Guelph did war work of various kinds, not Agent Orange, that was out at the other chemical plant, not in Guelph, though they were involved in some of it. Woods, et cetera, took part in creating various things. Leland's did some too. So wages sometimes went up, but you were expected, if you took a job at a plant and you were considered necessary, you weren't allowed to leave that job. You couldn't say, oh, well, I'm just, you know, I don't want to work there. The groups that were hardest hit, though, were farming. Because especially at that point, you could make a better wage working at a factory. You could work overtime. The pay was good. And that was a boon for single women. I think World War I allowed, and I'll use the word allowed because that was how it was looked at, for women to work. But I think World War II had a bigger effect on women because I think women were more consciously prepared to work and to not give up their jobs as easily as after World War I. And the ones that were most affected, though, were farming communities. So workers were often expected, if they worked it in a factory, if they had free time and they weren't devoting it to raising victory loans or anything like that at that time, or helping contribute, then they would be expected to work at farms. School kids went to work on farms. You had all various groups going out to Wellington County and even down to pick fruit in Niagara. And that would be considered something that you could do in your spare time after you finished a long day at work. So some industries were considered, you had to work there. You couldn't leave. If you were left, you could even be taken legally. And of course, during part of the time, strikes were made illegal. So you were not really allowed to strike. You could have grievances. And I think that's more when you had labor boards trying to work with employers and employees to make both happy so that the war work could continue. And then the as well, because of World War II, because of World War I, when World War II was ending, companies had a better idea of how to translate what they learned in production during the war to ship back to peacetime production. So there wasn't the big economic flop that came, because they said Roaring 20s wasn't really Roaring 20s to many companies. So there was, it was better. So, okay.
Okay. Hopefully that satisfies Phil's curiosity there. We have a couple niche questions, I would say, from Ted that remain. One, do you know anything about the Guelph dress designer who was on the Titanic? And two, did we cast cannons for the South in the Civil War?
Okay, the first one I know very little about. There was an exhibition at the museum about her. The second one, cannons, that's to do with the Robertson Foundry. The Robertson Foundry was located on Aramosa, just and the Robertson Foundry. The two, Adam Robertson Sr. and Adam Robertson Jr., and they had connections with relatives to the Southern United States. So during the time period of the Civil War, they sided with the South to an extent, and they made cannons and cannonballs, and they tried to actually smuggle them out down through the down through Windsor area, I think it was. And so what they did was they tried in potato sacks. They got caught, and one of their relatives who had initiated the scheme was actually arrested. So it goes at the farmer's market, picked up by the sheriff, brought back to the Robertson. And he was part of a plan to lead escapes from Johnson Island, which held a lot of Southern Civil War detainees, and they were kept there, and the conditions were absolutely horrible. So in the end, when there was a trial for this whole thing, you had people from the South having their legal stance, people from the North, and the British and Canadians. So it was quite a big trial. The Guelph Mercury, of course, covered it, but the Globe and Mail covered it, etc. But they actually did. The Robertsons had been making cannons for years as part of their foundry. They had one that they had in the town square, like had brought at one point the town square. And Adam Robertson actually fired at one time in the square, which pissed off Dr. Clark, who was a bit of a jerk at the time, and he took Robertson to court about it. The issue there was nobody really liked Clark. The judge had to find Robertson guilty, but rather than Robertson pay the fine on his own, everybody in the courtroom pitched in a little bit of money and paid his fine for him. Senior Robertson was really well respected. He was a foundry man, and in the era he was like city council, et cetera. The younger Robertson, not so much, because by then foundries were no longer as important as they were originally. Like Wolf had several foundries originally, including the Crow Foundry, but I could go on there. All right.
Bonnie, I think this is a great way to start the morning. A lot of people I'm seeing in the chat are saying that, you have such a wealth of information available that you should probably start a podcast. I don't think that's a bad idea, but that's up to you. Maybe this is a start, because we are going to convert this session into a podcast and also air it on.
And I could show up things like I have my Thanes turnip top planters, tops for turnip planters from 1888, and talk about Thanes Agricultural Company.
Yeah, something for everyone, right? So yeah, absolutely. We're looking forward to airing this to a wider audience, and hopefully people get more and more interested in your work, which, by the way, I wondered if maybe you want to just reiterate your email address, website, books, just for everybody to hear again.
Okay. My website, for which you'll find out more about laboring, Guelph labor history in a condensed form from the book, and focusing on Guelph, is at www.laboringallourlives, laboring spelled the Canadian spelling, allourlives.ca. That's on the net. It also includes, because I had to do something besides twiddle my thumbs during the months of the pandemic, I wrote various summaries of Guelph companies that used to be in Guelph, including strikes, accidents, and I know almost all the accidents that ever happened in Guelph in the 1800s that I run across. And that's that. My own email address is bmdurtnall@gmail.com.
Ran out of time again, that's all. Thanks as always to our guests and to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for any support you can lend, and as always, for listening.